On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Outgoing UN Secretary General Kofi Annan made his swan song in the U.S. yesterday, throwing Harry Truman at George Bush. From Truman's presidential library in Independence, Missouri, the UN leader said straight up that the world is in a sorry state and that the UN needed American support.
Americans did so much. You did so much in the last century to build an effective multilateral system with the United Nations at its heart. Do you need it less today? And does it need you less than 60 years ago?
As President Truman said, quoted Annan, the responsibility of the great states is to serve and not dominate the peoples of the world. Truman believed security must be collective and indivisible, said Annan. Harry Truman presided over the birth of the UN. George W. Bush has deeply challenged it. Some say abandoned it on Kofi Annan's watch. Up next, On Point, the U.S., the UN, and Kofi Annan's last appeal. Joining me now from New York is James Traub. He's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the new book, getting great reviews, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. James Traub, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Traub.
So here we are, Kofi Annan on the stump. And let's listen to a little more before we dive in here. A big speech very late in his term. He was insisting yesterday that it was not a rebuke of the Bush administration. The headlines all had it otherwise. Maybe not. But the message seemed pretty clear, as you'll hear in this excerpt.
As Truman said, and I quote again, we must once and for all prove by our acts conclusively that right is might. Right is might. That's why this country has historically been in the vanguard of global human rights movement. But that lead can only be maintained if America remains true to its principles, including in the struggle against terrorism. When it appears to abandon its own ideals and objectives, its friends abroad are naturally troubled and confused.
Kofi Annan yesterday in Independence, Missouri. James Traub, you spent a lot of time with this man, followed him for the better part of a year, talked to him again and again and again. What did you hear in this speech yesterday? Is this a major statement by Kofi Annan? Is this what he's been saying all along?
Well, yeah, that's part of the point, Tom, which is most of the time nobody listens to his speeches. Mm-hmm. I mean, the part you just played in which he said America has to play by the same rules that govern everybody else. Well, he's been saying that before, frankly. I think that the tone of this was a little bit more pointed. And of course, as you cleverly said at the beginning, he threw Truman at Bush, which is very much what it felt like, which is to say he was trying to recall to America why it had created this organization in the first place. My guess, not knowing, is that he probably thought that he was addressing the American people as much as he was addressing the Bush administration. That is, from the outset of his tenure, Annan, more than previous secretaries general, has spoken directly to the American people. He's gone to college campuses and so forth, you know, where he's been a terribly popular figure. And I think what he felt in a way was, I know the American people believe this, even though the Bush administration doesn't, so I'm going to remind them of it.
60% or so of Americans support the UN, we see in the polls. But that leaves an awful lot who do not, and a lot of them have been very prominent in Washington recently. But let's go back and get that sense of history, the Truman that was being thrown at George Bush yesterday, in our ears, if we may, James Traub, Jack. Here's October 1946. Now, FDR had begun the work. Harry Truman carried it on to bring the United Nations into being post-World War II. He spoke at the opening session of the UN General Assembly here, October 46. He spoke of a time when war and different philosophies had driven a wedge even among allies.
The war has left many parts of the world in turmoil. Differences have arisen among the allies. It will not help us to pretend that this is not the case. But it is not necessary to exaggerate those differences.
And then Harry Truman, October 1946, at the beginning, warned against a world in which differences were allowed to destroy the United Nations.
Above all, we must not permit differences in economic and social systems to stand in the way of peace, either now or in the future. To permit the United Nations to be broken into irreconcilable parts by different political philosophies would be disaster to the world.
Jack Beatty, it's a long time since 1946. Kofi Annan sort of throwing himself on Harry Truman there at the end of his time with George Bush has not been fun for him. But does it still resonate? It was a different war, a different time, in some respects a different world.
A different world, and you know, for so much of its history, the veto in the Security Council did make it sort of, as Truman was fearing, two blocks. And then when the Cold War was over, I think many people, I guess I did, thought that the UN would play a greater role because now the Soviet Union was gone and there wouldn't be that sort of standoff in the Security Council about common action. And yet yet I'm not sure that really happened. And you know, I think a lot of it is the UN represents a dream. It is something that people have wanted for hundreds of years, the idea of a transnational institution that would stand for the rule of law, stand above nations. And Woodrow Wilson, who was, of course, the big proponent of the basic UN idea, the League of Nations, put it so well when he spoke to a friend when he went to Paris to try to work for the League. He said, you know, people expect the war to end, the hungry expect us to feed them, the sick at heart to take care of them. What I seem to see, he said, with all my heart, I hope I am wrong, is a tragedy of disappointment. And I think in some way many people feel that way about the UN, a tragedy of disappointment, partly because one's expectations in this Wilsonian way are so high.
And yet, at the same time, there's a kind of tragedy of disappointment right now on the unilateral front playing out in Iraq so vividly. James Traub, there's a lot of detail that we want to get into with you this hour, but I was struck by something Warren Hoag reported in the New York Times about this final visit to Washington that Kofi Annan made last week. President Bush gave a dinner in his honor at the White House. One of the guests was John Bolton, who, of course, will not be going forward, the UN ambassador to the UN. The next morning, Bolton was asked if he and Kofi Annan had made peace at that farewell event, and Bolton said, "Nobody sang Kumbaya." That was put to Kofi Annan, who said, "But does he know how to sing it?" I mean, does this White House even know Kumbaya? Is there a completely different music still operating here, or has the kind of humble pie that George Bush is eating in Iraq turned any eyes back to the UN with more hope, more interest?
Well, you know, it's also interesting that Condi Rice reacted quite angrily to the speech yesterday, you know, and said, "How come we don't get any credit for the changes over the last 2 years?" And it strikes me that from the point of view of the administration, the UN is one of those second-tier issues where they don't really ever have to resolve clearly what they think about it. And so what tends to happen, you know, in this administration, there's such a deep divide of opinion, was before, still continues to be to some extent, you know, between what are broadly called realists and neocons. We can call them whatever we want. So you have this odd spectacle at the UN now that you have this person who was appointed as ambassador, John Bolton, who was seen as the emblem of the administration's views on the UN and, of course, was appointed in no small part because he was hostile to the institution. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you have a new Secretary of State, Condi Rice, who clearly has gotten Bush's ear in a way that her predecessor, Colin Powell, didn't, and has adopted a much more pragmatic policy towards the institution. I mean, it's worth pointing out that, frustrating though it is, we're now conducting our policy towards Iran, which is a matter of supreme importance to the United States, through the Security Council. Same with Lebanon. And so you have this funny situation of, on the one hand, this kind of rhetoric of repudiation, and on the other hand, this quite pragmatic and surprisingly deeply engaged relationship to the institution.
But there's a kind of I don't know, crosswinds here that you can never exactly tell if Washington wants to use the UN or tear it down. Do you see that moving toward, in the broadest terms, James Thompson, toward some kind of resolution, new understanding, new structures or reform that would make this ever a more smooth relationship?
Well, within certain parameters, yeah. Okay, it's better now than it was. For the first term was the worst period in many ways in the history of the institution. Although I also want to say this, that when Harry Truman said it would be a disaster if differences in social and economic systems paralyzed the UN, well, that's what happened. I mean, the UN was non-functional in the sense that we care about it in terms of peace and security issues. It was non-functional with a few small exceptions from 1947 until 1992.
Paralyzed now, because of the Cold War and the dueling vetoes in the Security Council, Soviet Union,
as
U.S.?
As Jack said, right. I mean, the veto kind of paralyzed everything. So that was bad. Was it a disaster for the world? I don't know. The world got on in its ugly way, you know, during that period. I do think, you know, having a functional UN actually has been a lot better for the world. For all of the tragic mishaps and the sense of failed expectations. If you look, for example, at how fewer civil wars there are today than there were, let's say, in the 1980s or 70s, there's a lot of reasons for it. One, though, is that you do have all of these circuit-breaking mechanisms, peacemaking, peacekeeping, and so forth, of which the UN is a very big part.
We're talking this hour about the U.S. and the U.N. as Kofi Annan makes his last appeal to America yesterday in Independence, Missouri, an appeal for international cooperation, international law. James Traub is with us. He's author of the new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the U.N. in the Era of American World Power. Here's Kofi Annan invoking Harry Truman to suggest that unilateral action, even by a superpower, isn't a good option.
The U.S. has given the world an example of democracy in which everyone, including the most powerful, is subject to legal restraint. Its current moment of world supremacy gives it a priceless opportunity to entrench the same principles at the global level. As Harry Truman said, we all have to recognize, no matter how great our strength, that we must deny ourselves the license to do always as we please.
That license was exercised very vividly when the U.S. went to war in Iraq without U.N. approval, Security Council approval. James Traub, to get a sense of the man behind these words, take us to that moment, a real low point for Kofi Annan. You describe him as responding with a kind of slow-motion collapse.
Yeah, but I just want to pull it back a little bit to understand why it was so painful for him. For him, I think that the question of should the war happen or not was secondary to the fact that the UN must make the decision. That is, he is a kind of UN absolutist. Annan believes that the world is a better place when the great issues are channeled through the Security Council and is always deeply disturbed when nations act unilaterally, which they always will.
But that's the structure of international law he was appealing to in the clip right now, saying you do it at home, everyone's subject to law, do it in the world, please.
Yes, but guess what? We're not the only ones who act unilaterally. I mean, the French, you know, basically sent troops into Cote d'Ivoire unilaterally because they thought, well, it's our former colony. But it matters how you do this. I mean, you try to repair the angry feelings afterwards. You also make a calculation as to how much pain it's going to cause. Now, to go back to Iraq, I think because it seems so clear that the United States was going to go to war anyway and that it wanted the good housekeeping seal of approval of the Security Council— and at the same time, it was taking a view that very few of its allies shared. It was always an impossible position because the U.S. wasn't going to be persuaded by others, but it turned out in the end the others weren't going to be persuaded by the U.S. Kofi's in the middle making phone calls to heads of state, you know, 10 times a day. But basically, it's over his head. I mean, this is it's too big an issue for the great powers, for the Secretary General to have any important role. And so it was enormously frustrating for him, and he felt the institution slipping towards a terrifying irrelevance, which was precisely what George Bush had threatened when he had come before the Security Council in September of 2002. So by the end of this thing, he was exhausted, and I think I don't want to say whether he was clinically depressed. He was just depressed in the ordinary usage of the word. And so I don't know whether
he shattered, as you describe it, retreating to his New York home, taking antidepressants. Presence lost his ability to speak for a while. What does that all mean? Did he think?
I don't think I said he took antidepressants.
I'm sorry, I've got that.
I may have said it elsewhere in the book, but I think not then. He by the way, says he did not. I asked him that question. Point blank.
I stand corrected.
But he didn't come to the office for several weeks, and he was said to have a sore throat, and he lost his voice, which you can't help but interpret symbolically. And he clearly had some kind of mental something, some break, some exhaustion, something that was not merely physical.
But if Kofi Annan personifies the UN in a sense, he was a career guy there, been there for so long, and this move shattered him so— Does it mean that he believed something else was going on? Was he that shocked and stunned when the U.S. took this move?
No, I don't think he believed something else was going on, and I don't think he was stunned either. He was shocked in the sense of profoundly upset. He wasn't even surprised. He knew it was going to happen mm-hmm. after a while, but he was still, for him, it just overthrew everything he believed in. I'm not even sure it was personal, though he was, you know, Dick Cheney attacked him and stuff like that. But I don't know how bad that was. I think the sense of institutional failure for him was really devastating because, you know, in some ways he doesn't seem to have an individual ego. The thing that he cares about is the institution, and he registers its successes and its failures in an intensely personal way. So I think what he was registering there was a kind of historic sense of the failure of the institution and that kind of a tragedy of disappointment that Jack referred to.
James Traub, Jack Beatty, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. From Washington, Lee Feinstein joins us. He's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, was staff director for the 2005 Gingrich-Mitchell Report commissioned by Congress to recommend ways to reform the UN. Lee Feinstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
We talked about this kind of exchange about who knows how to sing Kumbaya and who doesn't here. The music of Washington and the UN in New York, can it, will it ever get on the same page? Is it growing closer again after the great estrangement of the Iraq War's origins?
Well, the interesting thing about Kofi Annan's tenure is that he has been remarkably close in values and programs to American values and American interests, I think more so than almost any secretary general, and yet he has been vilified in parts of the American Congress. So I guess that would indicate that this is going to be a difficult relationship no matter who is in charge.
He came early from Ghana, went to college in the United States. Why would, how do you interpret that? If he embodies American values at some level, why he is the target of vilification?
Well, I think Kofi Annan made a couple of mistakes for which traditional critics of the United Nations never forgave him. And that was they were disinclined in any case to support any secretary general. But after Kofi Annan, in an offhanded comment during the heat of the 2004 presidential election, said that he thought that the Iraq War was illegal under international law, that was seen by several, particularly Republican members of Congress, as an effort to shape what happened in the American election. He also, on the eve of the vote, sent a letter to President Bush recommending against a planned assault on Fallujah in Iraq. And that was also seen and was very ill-advised, at least politically, coming from Kofi Annan as it did at that time.
James Traub, so I think I just wanted to ask you James, do you see that as a deliberate political intervention when Kofi Annan called the war illegal?
Oh, God, no. Though that one is easy to call. We can talk about the other one. The illegal thing happened in the following way. Kofi has a real weakness for BBC. You know, he's kind of an Anglophile. And so a BBC journalist whom he had not known before and who wasn't playing by the usual delicate rules of the UN beat press said to him, "Sir, was the war illegal?" He said, "No, it was illegitimate." "Oh, yes, but was it illegal?" He said, "No." This happened three times. Mm-hmm. The fourth time, he just got exasperated or he forgot his lines or whatever, and he said, "Okay, it's illegal." That was got extorted from him. The Fallujah letter, in a way, looks much worse because it was released the day before the election. And so it became common, it became a consensus wisdom in Washington that he was trying to throw the vote to Kerry. Well, it's an example of a stupid thing which anybody on the outside assumed would have the purpose that it wound up having. But in fact, well, they didn't think about that. I mean, that was a really dumb move on his part and I think indicates the level of frustration that he had. But he somehow didn't think it would get leaked. I mean, this is right before the election. He thought, you know, nobody would know. Not good thinking on his part.
Lee Feinstein, do you see a fundamental conflict here between a superpower's interests and the whole idea of this body, despite what Harry Truman said 50 years ago? Or is this a kind of fixable thing? You looked at reform efforts at the UN. Could the UN be mechanically jiggered around, restructured, changed so that the it would work better with the U.S. Let's say.
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, to criticize the UN is a bit of self-criticism, of course. First of all, the machinery of the UN was devised principally by Americans, and it was devised in a way so that it couldn't take strong action without the support of its most prominent member. So that both serves American interests, and at times it frustrates.
It is only the member nations, we're constantly reminded.
Yeah, and it was interesting. On this task force that you were referring to earlier that I served on, Newt Gingrich and George Mitchell had a very interesting statement about genocide. And what they said, and I'll paraphrase, was, on stopping genocide, all too often the United Nations failed, should really read, members of the United Nations blocked or undermine action by the United Nations. So I think that there's an appreciation, a cross-partisan appreciation, if you put it that way, that, you know, while the institution itself is to blame for some of these things, that also it is also easy to offset the blame onto the institution when, in fact, the failure to act is principally due to a lack of political will and largely within the Security Council.
And yet, there's the UN supposed to be kind of the nozzle at the end of that hose, and lately not working so well. Let me go to our listeners. In Alexandria, Virginia, David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment that it seems pretty clear today when the United States takes unilateral action, especially the war in Iraq, that leads to the mess that we're in. You know, it seems that terrorism specifically is a multilateral problem, and it's going to require a multilateral solution. I would say that the UN is very relevant today.
So a thumbs up for it there, and a lot of Americans feel that way, even while there's so much criticism out there. Jack Beatty, do you see, when you hear Harry Truman at the end of World War II waxing on about how much we need this, do you look back on that as a high point? Do you hope or believe or fear that we come back to that much multilateralism again? Is the UN ever going to make it happen?
Well, as Anand said, the fact is that states can no longer, if they ever could, confront global challenges alone. I mean, the logic of this is just so clear. He talked about the poverty. Disease doesn't follow boundaries, environmental refugees, all of these things, terrorism. Non-state actors, both in institutions and in the people who want to subvert them, that's just the coin now of international relations, and this is the only place where that can be addressed. So it would seem that given and climate change, he mentioned that too, given all these transnational challenges, that this should be or could be a renaissance time for the UN if somehow it can find a way to be bigger than the sum of its parts, which I think is what part of that disappointment again. We always want it to be bigger than the aggregation of all these national interests. And yet it can't in some, you know, it's limited by them.
We'd like to see, but at some level, it's even smaller than any one of those parts because it can't act independently. I guess it never would. Let me get a call from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. John, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd just like to say, with respect to, I'm a blue-collar worker, just my view on the United Nations addressing of Darfur, I agree with your panelists that the United Nations is only what the countries are made up of and what they expect of the organization itself. But I just feel like study groups, I was listening to a prior show, study groups aren't needed for us and the world to find out that women, children, men are dying in the hundreds of thousands, and action needs to be taken, not unilaterally, multilateral action. It's time for the world to understand that they would never let that happen to each individual country, so let's not let that happen to Darfur.
But what does Darfur say about the United Nations in particular, John, that it's effective or absolutely not?
I would say not, Tom, because people can't get on the same page. I hear the world belittle my country. I live right near the Eisenhower Farm in Gettysburg, and he was a great general. He did what he was told, but we are a country of action, and we need other countries to act as well along with us, not by ourselves, to rat out, and this, it is a genocide, and we can either close our eyes to it or open our eyes and start acting here on. Thanks, Tom.
John, thanks for your call. James Traub, how about Darfur and Kofi Annan? How has he chewed that one over? He was there right in the middle of Rwanda, of the Balkans and the UN failures there. How does he look at this one and the UN as an institution?
It would be unfair if it were said that this guy, was in some sense responsible for these two different genocides. Rwanda is a complicated case. I think there's some real culpability there on the part of the peacekeeping department, which Kofi Annan headed at the time. In the case of Darfur, which came along 10 years after Rwanda, it's very hard, I think, to blame him. He spoke up early, and he spoke up passionately. He even talked about the idea of humanitarian intervention, but nobody wanted to hear about it. And I also wanted to take this opportunity to say that, we've been talking as if the principal obstacle to this multilateral institution functioning is the Bush administration and the United States. Well, it is a big obstacle for all the reasons we've been saying. But you can look at Darfur and see that we are scarcely the problem there. I mean, I think Washington has been really, too much talk about genocide and then too little action. But Washington has been more aggressive and more persistent on this subject than any other country.
You're looking over your shoulder at China, for example.
Well, yes. So both, on any of these humanitarian issues where the question is, do we do something a country doesn't want us to do in order to punish it or in some way make it stop mistreating its own citizens? China is automatically opposed to it. And so in almost all cases are Russia. And we're actually in the peculiar situation that in some ways the Cold War divide has returned to the Security Council with China and Russia on one side and the three Western powers on the other, even though we're no longer separated by that single great ideological gulf that Truman talked about.
Lee Feinstein, how about it then? We've got an American impulse among many Americans to make this work, and yet we see the practical difficulties. We saw them in the Cold War. We see them right now in Darfur. So what does that mean? Poor effort into reforming or changing the UN, or just recognize its limits and work around them?
Well, this takes me back to a clip that you had earlier by Annan, which was states don't have a license to do always as we please. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize the word always because while there's been a lot of emphasis about Kofi Annan talking about multilateralism, I look at his legacy as somebody who's prepared to support unilateralism or at least action outside the United Nations in the face of mass atrocities of the kind we're seeing in Darfur and of the kind we saw in the former Yugoslavia. And he took on really a taboo for any secretary general by talking about the problems of Security Council deadlock and the immorality of doing nothing when the Security Council can't act. And that, I think, is really an unusual and courageous position for a secretary general to take. And, of course, very much in keeping with the American approach, which views the UN, I think correctly, as one way to address difficult foreign policy problems, but not the exclusive way.
Kathy's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a middle-aged, card-carrying liberal who has always been a fan of the UN. Recently picked up a book by Kenneth Kane, Heidi Postlewaite, and Andrew Thompson as I was going through an airport. The book is called Emergency Sex and Other Desperate Measures, A True Story from Hell on Earth. And the book chronicles these three young adults, these passionate idealists' experiences in Bosnia, Rwanda, various Cambodia, various other places.
Working for the UN, as I recall.
Yeah, they're working for the UN. And again, signing on because they really wanted to be a force for good.
And what was the heart of their disillusionment?
Their heart of disillusionment was standing by as members of the UN and watching the genocide happen. And I appreciate all the discussion that's gone on in the past 20 or so minutes about the role of the UN and Kofi Annan in these relatively recent genocides. But my question is one of a kind of conundrum. I don't like war. I'm a relatively pacifist-leaning person. But is the role or the definition of what the UN is supposed to do in the world fundamentally wrong? Does it need, rather than being a peacekeeping force, does it need to be a war-making force, or to at least have guns as well as butter to try and stop cold what is happening on the ground in front of them without having to wait so quickly or wait so slowly for places like Washington or Paris to jump in and
right.
give support.
Right, and yet it is Washington and Paris under the covers, I guess. But Lee Feinstein, you hear the report that's coming back from the field here and the voices of these UN workers who felt ineffective in the face of crisis. And you hear Kathy's question, is there some way to gear it up? Or is that the illusion that always lets us down, that there is no way because it's not a sovereign state?
Well, first of all, it's a very, very good question, and it's a very interesting comment. On the broader point, the caller's comment reflects declining public support for the United Nations in the United States, including people who self-identify as liberals and mm-hmm. Democrats. And I think that that's very interesting and important, and that's been a factor since 2003 and the Security Council meltdown over Iraq. Should the UN have a peace a war-making capacity. Of course, originally in the concept of the UN and in the UN Charter, there was such a thing. But it's been, it was stillborn and never enacted. And I think the way the United Nations thinks about itself now is that it does peacekeeping and it reluctantly does something that you might call peace enforcement or find another term. In a lot of the instances where the UN is sent in now, it is not in a neutral role. It is in a role where it has does and acts very closely to taking the position of being a combatant, involved very much in conflict. The UN doesn't like doing this, but the reality is that the Security Council asks them to do it again and again. In the UN's track record, while far from perfect, and this is an interesting book, but while far from perfect, it's probably better than the U.S. Record, at least according to some interesting studies by Rand and other places, where if you look at the goals set up for various peacekeeping operations and what they've accomplished, the UN track record over time is better than, say, the U.S. Record in Iraq or Afghanistan.
James Traub, I wonder, you hear in Kathy's comment this frustration with a lack of action. Is there something in the structure of the UN? I mean, is it there as a kind of deliberate muffler or a place to let the gears slip while the powers aren't ready to act? And is it possible that the UN, in its structure, in the way it actually functions, over time may or has even eroded support for the whole idea that's supposed to be at the heart of it?
Well, there is no question. I think what that question really goes to is this feeling the UN is a soft place in a hard world. And how can we take it seriously if it's unwilling to rise to the level of confrontation required in the face of real evil? And there aren't good answers to that question, but there are answers to that question. One is the UN cannot in the end really – well, several things. One is capacity. The UN does not have the capacity to do that kind of fighting. You couldn't possibly stick the UN in a place like Iraq. And even in Afghanistan, those are NATO troops that are there, not UN troops. So the UN can't do it itself. Now, but the real question is, why can't the UN authorize that to be done? Why can't the UN cause that to be done, whether it's in the Balkans or elsewhere? And there we go to a problem that's not properly the UN. It's the countries in question. Why does nobody act in Darfur? Why was action so dilatory in Bosnia? Why was there no action in Rwanda? And, you know, in the end, these are sovereign countries making the calculations that sovereign countries make. And the idea that because there is a UN, they will therefore transcend those merely sovereign calculations to make these kinds of global good calculations, well, it doesn't happen in matters that are life and death matters. That is to say, the United States, but neither other countries as well, it turns out, is willing to send sons and daughters to faraway places of no strategic importance in order to prevent mass slaughter. And that's a sickening fact. But right now, it appears to be a fact.
So, Jack, does that leave the UN as a kind of illusion that over time undercuts support for its what was to be its basic impetus?
You can wind up feeling that way, and I think Kathy states it so well. You know, Brian Urquhart, who was for years a UN official, has talked about this, and he has long recommended that, in fact, the UN does have, should have, a war-fighting or peacemaking capacity, a kind of international brigade or division or whatever, that there really should be a military arm. so that it can intervene. Of course, that begs all the questions that James just raised about the countries not allowing it through the Security Council.
By the way, I should add that Brian's idea is that there be a standing force, but not that it have that kind of war-making capacity. I think what he talks about is being able to very quickly mobilize a force so that they can act quickly.
Ready
it would
force,
not be
not
a force like it.
Yes,
but the point is it would not be a killing force.
Mm-hmm. But it would be able to intervene in humanitarian situations. Isn't that the idea, partly?
Not really, no. It's much more that it would still be able to go in where it was invited in. It would be robust, but it would not be a military force. He thinks peacekeepers should not take one side or the other. He says as soon as they do, they're compromised.
Let me get a call from Ian in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I wanted to call in and remind everyone of something that was said by a very intelligent man. Albert Einstein believed that for the preservation of human society and peace globally, we needed a strong world government. And reading his book out of my later years, I've come to agree with that. I'm a young 26-year-old idealistic liberal. But I do believe that with a return to a sort of international humility and submission to the idea that we will eventually need to abide by global rules, we can establish such a world government and bring about change for the better.
So you're for it, and then on the other side we get the black helicopter crowd who's terrified of the idea of world government. Lee Feinstein, do these twain ever meet? I mean, we've talked about all kinds of sovereign countries who don't necessarily want to abide by the UN or wait for the UN. But on the other hand, Europe at least has adopted the posture of willingness to go more down the international law world government road. Is that a viable road somewhere in the future or never?
Well, look, there's a fundamental conflict between democracy and justice, I guess, in this case. And there's a perception by some people that the UN ought to be a democracy and that every country ought to get one vote, one country, one vote. And somehow that one country, one vote also is somehow an indication of fairness. But the UN structure itself is a compromise. There's a Security Council where, in theory, the more powerful countries get more of a say, and there's a General Assembly where everybody has an equal say. And this, frankly, is a better arrangement than the kind of arrangement that Ian was talking about. There's a problem of democratic accountability. The UN's members are largely democracies now. That is a huge change from the past, but it's not exclusively democracies, and certainly the Security Council itself has non-democracies on it. So to give the UN some kind of parliamentary role would be, I think, fundamentally undemocratic and wrong. But I think what Ian points out, and your reference to, Tom, to the black helicopters, is how this debate is played out and what's underneath the debate about the UN. Because for the principled opponents of the UN in Congress and elsewhere, they view the problem of the UN as a problem of an infringement on American sovereignty. And the greater legitimacy the UN has, the less authority they see the United States having. And that's the root of their concern. And they tend to view people who support the UN as secretly also supporting world government and a giving up of American sovereignty.
James Traub, how do you interpret Kofi Annan on this front? A secret supporter of real world government, or an overt supporter, or just wishing that the Security Council and UN member nations would play nicer together?
You know, Tom, I'm not at liberty to disclose
yes,
his
right.
secret
just
conspiratorial
between us,
plans,
right.
but as we speak, nobody, I think, anymore holds out hope, nor personally do I think they should, for the idea that we're all going to kind of collapse our sovereignty and turn the world into a version of the European Union. It's not going to happen, and that's not what Kofi Annan wants.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue comes down to something like this, though. To what extent are we and other countries willing to circumscribe our own freedom of action in order to get this good thing that can only be provided by an organization of all the countries in the world? Now, many of the problems we've talked about are inherent in an organization of all the countries in the world. You can't have a streamlined, efficient, readily consensus-forming body if it has all the countries in the world. You can't. And yet at the same time, if there's this precious thing called legitimacy, you won't have it unless everybody is part of the organization. And so then the question is going to arise, okay, given all those limits, but given the actual value of this good thing called legitimacy, to what extent, what kinds of limitations will we accept in the sense that Truman meant by saying we must act as if we did not have the kind of freedom of action that, in fact, we do have.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the kind of skirmish line of this. And I think the Bush administration has gone as far as you can go in the direction of we're not giving much of anything. And I think what we have to hope for is a movement back towards a recognition that this is a good worth having and worth making some sacrifices for.
Maybe experience pushes us there. Let's take a call from West Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Suzanne is on the line. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I was delighted the 26-year-old caller called in. I think that the UN will be embraced and its ideals will be embraced more by this younger generation. I have an 18-year-old son who's an international affairs student in Washington, D.C. Even though we're from the Midwest, which we you would think is more isolated, I think with globalization and the Internet and the recognition of the lack of functional international interaction, I think this younger generation actually will embrace that more because some of the mistakes was that we had people like Cheney and Rumsfeld, who had been involved in international affairs since the 80s, still making the old-fashioned decisions. So I think there is hope with this next generation that those ideas will be re-embraced.
So that a kind of networked generation may see that network as naturally including the whole world, Suzanne.
Absolutely.
There's a vision. James, what do you think?
I think it's a lovely vision. Look, I think Cheney and Rumsfeld have done a lot for multilateralism. They've done a lot for the idea of prudence. That is to say, their failures are so manifest that you think, okay, we know that path didn't work. What's the opposite or what's a different one? I do think, as I was saying a minute ago, that it's like this experiment in physics has been performed and we've pushed this thing as far as it can go and the somehow the natural laws of the universe have pushed back. And so that's why the administration has been more pragmatic and more amenable on this stuff. And I think it is open-ended, and I hope it's open-ended and therefore debate-worthy as to whether the United States is going to will behave in a different way that in turn will provoke others to behave in a different way or whether we'll continue this unilateralist thing which will license the unilateralism of others.
Lee Feinstein, how do you see it? Kofi Annan headed out, Ban Ki-moon, his successor, headed in, and George Bush now on the other side of a rough midterm election. Condoleezza Rice already saying, look, we've turned a corner in the last couple of years. Do you see the U.S. getting back to a more amenable attitude toward the U.N. as it forced back into that position by facts on the ground?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, I worked in the Clinton administration in the Defense Department, in the Peacekeeping Office, and then for Madeleine Albright at the State Department. And I saw, and I think all of us saw towards the end of the those years, it becoming increasingly difficult to work on a multilateral basis by virtue of being the United States. And the interesting thing that
because
the
Bush administration, we were just too big, too powerful? What? Why?
We were big. We were too powerful. After the Kosovo War, the Europeans were humiliated. There was a sense of wanting to put the United States back in its place. And this predated the Bush administration. So this is sort of an inherent structural problem of being number one.
But we won't be necessarily such the towering superpower forever. I mean, Bill Clinton said one of his parting ideas was, you know, embrace the UN because the U.S. may need its protections one day.
Well, I think that fundamentally the Bush administration has recognized that as a practical matter, it cannot be as muscular in its foreign policy and as aggressive in its foreign policy as it has been because the United States is pinned down in Iraq and Afghanistan, and its foreign policy energy and attention is sapped. The Bush administration had an opportunity. It created a lot of negotiating space when it pushed back so hard against the United Nations and other multilateral institutions. And it could have used that opportunity to reform those institutions and push them in a better direction. But it is, I think, too late for the Bush administration to take advantage of that opportunity. And it is probably going to be for a new American administration to pick up.
That space may be gone. Maybe we're back in the same boat, or at least different ends of it. Lee Feinstein at the Council on Foreign Relations, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And James Traub, author of the new book on Kofi Annan, The Best Intentions. Wonderful book, James. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, great to have you, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.